So while my presentation is loading, I just thought I would thank the organizers for inviting me to speak today. And also to say that in my presentation, I'm going to be moving not only a little bit bigger scale than some of the field investigations that have been talked about this morning, but also looking at time series that are of much longer length. A lot of my research recently has been on looking at long-term climate change impacts on groundwater recharge, and in this particular study, I'm focusing on an area where we have nitrate data as well. So I'm going to look at the nitrate data a little bit from a forensic perspective and then try to draw some inferences about future climate change as well. So I'm going to start with the sort of thought for the talk, which is that climate change and climate variability have the potential to alter groundwater recharge and nitrate loading in agricultural areas. And this, I think, is sort of goes without saying, but I think the data set that I'll be presenting really sheds some light into this. So as an outline for my presentation, I'm going to talk about the Abbotsford-Sumas aquifer. So we've seen that once before today. Edwin Say talked about the aquifer. I'll talk about the historic nitrate variability, some nitrate loading simulations that we've done in the study area, potential changes in recharge using different global climate models, and also the implications for nitrate loading. So here we are. This is British Columbia on the top and Washington State on the bottom, and the study area is located in the Lower Fraser Valley. This is a largely agricultural area, so Vancouver is just up in this area here. This is the Fraser River, and the Abbotsford-Sumas aquifer is shown by the outline here. So a portion of it is in Canada, and then the other remaining part of it is down in the United States. And this is a little bit larger outline or footprint of the aquifer than is typically seen. It's amalgamating a series of aquifers that extend down to the Nooksack River in the south. As I mentioned, the area is largely agricultural, but groundwater is also used for drinking water purposes. Here's an example of the types of sediment that form the Abbotsford-Sumas aquifer. So the aquifer is largely unconfined over the whole study area. And you can see by the very coarse grain size distribution in this photo that the aquifer also is highly permeable. Here's a close-up shot of the type of material that we're looking at in this aquifer. So when we're talking about groundwater recharge or nitrate loading to the aquifer, it's going to be a very rapid process. This map you also saw previously this morning. So this is a land use map in the Abbotsford area. This triangle here is the Abbotsford International Airport, and there's a climate station located at that. The pink colors are berry farms, and so berry production is the dominant land use, agricultural land use in this area. The general groundwater flow direction from across the whole aquifer is largely from Canada towards the United States. And so this has prompted a number of investigations over the years into the potential for nitrate contamination originating on the Canadian side and moving down to the U.S. side. Although the U.S. Partners in this aren't free of their obligation as well, because there's also significant loading of the aquifer in nitrate on the U.S. side as well. So here's just a photo of the berry farms. Pardon me. So the monitoring network that was installed in this whole area was largely led by Environment Canada, but the BC Ministry of Environment has also contributed to the monitoring. So this map shows a number of Environment Canada's monitoring wells. And the network was originally developed to characterize the distribution of nitrate concentration in the aquifer. It consists of 60 monitoring points, 30 of which are sampled on a monthly basis, and these are spatially distributed throughout the area, but they're also spatially distributed with depth. So these are multi-level installations that have been installed. In 2005, we took a look at the historic data for the aquifer and generated this map here that shows the spatial distribution of nitrate concentration in the aquifer spanning a period from 2002 to 2004. So this was just a window on the nitrate concentrations. And you can see a couple of hot spots that are located to the south east of the Abbotsford Airport. So here's the airport. And other hot spots along the border. So only Canadian data, unfortunately, were available for this. And after revisiting the data, I might add, trying to collect more information from the U.S. side, the data are so sparse on the U.S. side that we can't even extend this map reliably today in that area. So a lot more monitoring really does need to take place across this border right here. We also looked at the difference in nitrate concentrations at those points that had data from two different time periods. So from the 1992 time period to 2004, this is the difference in nitrate contributions, nitrate concentrations. So based on the color scheme at the side here, we're looking at very little variation over time in the nitrate concentrations. And this is reflected in this graph as well. So going from September 91 through to October 09, we see that the average nitrate concentrations in the monitoring well, so this is looking at them as a whole group, ranged between 12 and 16 milligrams per liter nitrate nitrogen with spikes as high as 90. So this is that spike in the 90. But overall, this along this whole period of record, the average nitrate concentration has not changed. So this is somewhat interesting, given that in around 1992, the province made an effort to introduce beneficial management practices over the aquifer. And that called for a move away from manure-based fertilizer in favor of inorganic fertilizer, as well as removal of stockpiles of manure and removing from the area any excess nitrogen that would be in the form of manure. So a lot of that manure is moved out of the actual area. Unfortunately, the production of berries has increased in the area at a rate that equals the amount of manure that's being removed from the area. So over the on the whole, there really hasn't been a net loss. One of the things that we found rather interesting when we looked at this data set, so it looks like buckshot. The red line across the bottom here is the 10 milligram per liter nitrogen line. Sorry, I'm actually, And all of the blue dots are the nitrate concentrations that have been measured in, all of the monitoring wells through the area. This orange line shows the groundwater level variability measured in observation number, observation well 8. And the blue line here is a 99-point moving average for all of the data. And so clearly what we see is a good correlation between this groundwater level variability and the concentrations of nitrate with time. So the question was, in my mind, is that cyclicity real? And if we do a little bit more rigorous analysis of the nitrate variability other than a moving average, would we see something that's a little more impressive? And secondly, how long does it take nitrate introduced at the surface to reach the water table? And so to do that, we looked at some nitrate leaching simulations. So monthly nitrate concentration appears to correlate with precipitation more strongly than it does with groundwater level variation, interestingly enough. So on this graph at the bottom, we have in blue precipitation, and in green we have our nitrate concentrations. And you can see, first of all, that the dashed green and blue lines are actually fairly nicely correlated. But the other thing that's really standing out on this is longer period cycles. That appear to influence the average nitrate concentrations by as much as 30% of the maximum allowable concentration. So the shallow wells, for example, PB20, which is on the left-hand side in this graph, this is a 5-meter deep well. It shows a strong cross-correlation between nitrate and precipitation at lags of about 12 months, with a delay in the nitrate concentration of about 3 months. In the deeper wells, so this would be represented by PB25 on the right, 15 meters deep, there's a strong negative correlation at lags of multiples of 12 months, suggesting a 9-month delay. So the shallower wells are responding 3 months delayed with respect to precipitation, and the deeper wells are showing a longer lag. The apparent correlation for individual monitoring wells is likely influenced by a number of different factors. So for example, the time of travel along a groundwater flow path, which is indicated by groundwater age, and there has been a lot of work done on groundwater age in this study area. Also, the proximity to nitrate sources at land surface, and finally, the variable nutrient management practices at land surface. So on the top and bottom, again, we see PB20, which is our shallow piezometer, and very strong correlation both at this low frequency and also high frequency, and also a pretty apparent correlation at the lower frequency, whereas if we have this deeper observation well, we don't see as much of a correlation. So we looked a little bit further at this with a spectral analysis. So shown in blue is precipitation for the Abbotsford International Airport. These data are for PB20. And in orange is the nitrate concentration. So what we clearly see, ignore the numbers at the bottom, what we clearly see here is an annual peak coming through with our nitrate concentration, correlating reasonably well with precipitation on an annual basis. But we also see very strong spectral frequency that corresponds to 3 to 5 years. So what's driving this long-term groundwater nitrate cyclic variability? We think that this is related to ENSO cycles that are affecting the nitrate concentrations, although at this time the mechanism isn't quite clear. And the reason for that is that we know that cycles come through this particular area. We have cold phase or La Nina or neutral cycles that are typically associated with wetter conditions, while the warm phase, El Nino, has drier conditions. So whether or not it's more precipitation in the fall or the spring that is causing an additional nitrate concentrations or to be higher at that time of the year, or whether it's a warmer summertime with enhanced irrigation, we're not quite sure what's the controlling mechanism. Previous studies in the area have also shown that ENSO impacts precipitation. ENSO effects on precipitation also affect the stream flow and groundwater levels by 50% of the average seasonal cycle amplitude, and this was shown by Fleming and Quilty in 2006. So we did some nitrate loading simulations just to look at the timing of if you apply nitrate to the ground surface, how long might it take to get down to the water table. So we have a very thick vadozone in some parts of this aquifer, well, very thick, meaning up to about 25 meters or so, and as shallow as 3 to 5. So the nitrate loading was simulated with CEPW, with the transport part CTRAN. A monthly net average recharge flux from April to November for the period 2000 to 2003 was applied to the top of the model, so we applied net recharge at the top. We made the assumption that irrigation occurs only in the summer months from June to September, and it was estimated at 450 millimeters total over, or 112 millimeters a month over that time period. And so what we were doing was looking at if we have this net applied recharge, which is precipitation and irrigation minus evapotranspiration, how long does it take to come through that column, and what would the concentration of nitrate be at the bottom? So a couple of other points. We applied a specified concentration of nitrogen in the form of inorganic fertilizer at the soil surface on the 15th of April, which corresponds to the time of the year when farmers are beginning to apply. And we assume nitrification occurs instantaneously. The net mass of nitrogen applied to the model was 216 kilograms per hectare, and this amount was converted to 1,200 milligrams nitrogen per liter to the top centimeters of the soil. So here's the results. What I want to point out firstly is that if we had a rain event in the early spring that was significant, then we start to see mobilization of nitrate through this soil horizon. The peak or the first arrival of nitrate at the water table occurs about 4 months later, so sometime between July and August, and this was for a 10-meter long vadose zone. If we had 25 meters, given the high permeability of the material, it didn't shift this arrival time to much later than 4 months, maybe 4.5 to 5. So we're looking at a 4 to 5 month delay between when the fertilizer is applied at surface or when a heavy rain event actually occurs at the surface and the time it takes for that nitrate to hit the water table. So now looking forward with this information, how might climate change impact nitrate loading? The general methodology that we've been using for the past while with a number of studies that I've been conducting has been as follows. So we start off with global climate model data. We downscale those data to give us climate time series for a particular study area, such as here. In this particular study, we used historical climate data to compare to. And then we looked at four different global climate models and what the projections would be to the recharge for those four different climate models. We map recharge spatially across the aquifer, taking into account soil permeability, soil thickness, aquifer permeability, and water table depth. We run a recharge model, and then we produce recharge spatially variable for different times of the year. So these are the very interesting results that came about. So these are the four different global climate models that were tested. And these first set here across the top row represent the 2020s, this row the 2050s, and this row the 2080s. And so, for example, if we look at the 2080s, recharge as a spatial average across the whole aquifer could be, if we chose this particular climate model, minus 1.5% relative to today, or if we chose this climate model, plus 23.2% relative to today. So the selection of GCM is, and the results that you get is very, very uncertain. So if we start to want to use global climate models for future prediction of recharge, we really have to be looking at a range of GCMs. This is my last slide. And this also, given the results of the nitrate loading, is telling as well. So for again, for the four different climate models, these results are color-coded, blue for the 2020s, purple for the 2050s, and white for the 2080s. So white probably is going to stand out for you best at the back of the room. It doesn't matter which model you use, but for the most part, the spring precipitation is higher for all of these models, and the summer precipitation is lower. So this has two implications. First of all, if we did really have nitrate being mobilized in the spring due to heavy rain events or a lot more rain, then all of these models are predicting that rain will end up being or there will be more rain during the spring. So that could translate into having greater nitrate loading to the aquifer. Similarly, during the summer months, the the rainfall is predicted to be lower. So that would mean greater irrigation and perhaps mobilization of nitrate during the summer as well. So conclusions for the talk are that, first of all, from the historical data, there's clear correlation between annual precipitation and nitrate concentration. Longer-term variability in precipitation and recharge appears to affect the nitrate concentration. So the take-home message there is that if you start looking at trends in nitrate concentration, be very aware of ENSO cycles, because you can have a decline in nitrate concentration being completely unrelated to something other than climate variability. And then finally, with regard to the simulations, spring recharge we think begins nitrate mobilization in some cases, and if we look at GCM results, they're highly variable, making projections very uncertain. And of course, ENSO at this time is not really captured in these global climate models yet, so that's something to bear in mind. And the implications are that we need to consider changes in the seasonality of recharge specifically rather than annual changes because of the timing of fertilizer application and changes in irrigation demand. And so with that, I'll conclude, and I want to draw your attention to a number of collaborators for this project, as well as students and postdocs. Thank you very much.